Just more than a week later, they wed at the Methodist Church in Franklin, Kentucky. Merle Kilgore stood up as best man, and the reception was alcohol-free. Cash and June didn't honeymoon immediately, but waited until after a tour of Britain in May to travel to Israel. They visited Nazareth, the town where Jesus grew up, the area around the Sea of Galilee where his early ministry took place, and sites of Jerusalem, including the disputed site of the crucifixion and the Via Dolorosa. Cash, who had only been to Israel once before, was gripped by the sights, sounds, and smells of this land and spoke his thoughts at each site into a tape recorder. At a jewelry shop, they each bought the other a ring engraved with, "Me to my love and my love to me," in Hebrew. Just as Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison began to climb the charts in 1968, a 30-year-old director, Robert Elstrom, began shooting a documentary on the singer. His film opens with Cash out hunting in the woods with his rifle. He downs a crow, but when he realizes he has only wounded it, he playfully caresses it. "Be still. Be still," he urges it as it tries to peck his finger. "I already like you for some reason. I'm going to charm you yet." With the bird firmly gripped in one hand and his rifle in the other, he strolls on through the long grass, composing a song as he goes. "If I could fly like Mr. Crow, I know where I would go. I would leave you. I would leave you." He eventually completed and even copyrighted the song, Mr. Crow, in 1970, but never recorded it. It was an unusual and arresting opening to a film about the life of a popular singer. Elstrom used it because he thought that it encapsulated Cash's contradictions. Here was a man, though capable of destruction, who became overwhelmed with a desire to repair what he had destroyed. A nonviolent man who had a love affair with guns. An artist who could cause suffering and then turn that suffering into art. "John is all of those people," says Elstrom. "He would sit around his house and get bored, and so he'd say, 'Let's go outside and get a crow.' He wounded the crow, and then he spent the next day or two trying to mend it. He was driving around to doctors and vets and buying gaffer tape to fix the bird's leg. There was a whole Dr. Doolittle thing going on." The idea of making a documentary had originated with Harry Weiland, a 22-year-old graduate film student at Columbia University, who, with the help of a tutor, secured $175,000 from the Public Broadcast Library. They pitched the idea to Saul Holliff in a letter and secured Cash's participation. Elstrom, active in the Cinema Verite School of Filmmaking in New York, had filmed documentaries in Vietnam and Central America, was hired to direct even though he knew little about Johnny Cash. With no planned outline, he hung around Cash intermittently for 8 months, filming him relaxing at home, traveling to concerts in his Dodge RV, recording, performing, returning to Dias, and listening to his father sing. "He was just in a great place in his life, and so was June," says Elstrom. "I just hit it off with both of them. John is the kind of guy who looks you in the eye when he makes a decision. He's very earthy. He makes decisions with his stomach and his heart, and I guess that he figured that I was good enough. Once he had made that decision, he just opened and opened as the film went on. He became more and more revealing and trusting. I've been making documentaries for over 40 years now, and that was one of the highlights of my life." Elstrom captured Cash in July 1968 with Bob Johnston recording Land of Israel for the Holy Land album, based on the tape-recorded impressions Cash had made in Israel. 7 months later, in the same studio, Elstrom filmed him cutting his first Kris Kristofferson song, The Devil to Pay, with Carl Perkins on guitar and harmonies. Kristofferson, who'd been in Nashville for 3 years working at menial jobs to support his family while he wrote, pitched songs to Cash on a regular basis. Most celebrated is the time Kristofferson once flew a National Guard helicopter up to Hendersonville, landed on the Cash property, and hand-delivered a cassette demo. Legend has it that the track was Sunday Morning Coming Down, but Kristofferson says it was It No Longer Matters, a song that neither of them ever recorded. "I figured it would get his attention," he says of the stunt. "So many times Luther would say, 'John loves that song of yours,' but he wouldn't record them. He never knew what he was going to do." Kristofferson was part of a new generation of songwriters who wanted to shake up Nashville by broadening the parameters of what was acceptable in country music. His songs were more sexually frank, drug-aware, urban, and socially concerned than the traditional Opry fare. Kristofferson was also more consciously literary, having studied English literature at Oxford University for a year on a Rhodes Scholarship. He enjoyed the poet William Blake as much as he enjoyed Hank Williams and wasn't afraid to use allusion. alliteration, and other rhetorical devices in his lyrics. As with his friends Mickey Newberry, Chris Gantry, and Vince Matthews, he had more in common with Bob Dylan, John Lennon, and the culture of the Monterey Pop Festival than he did with George Jones, Porter Wagoner, and the Grand Ole Opry. For them, Johnny Cash remained one of the archetypal Nashville rebels, a man who defied the country ethos of his day by recording songs that drew attention to Native American rights, who'd been banned from the Opry, and whose credentials had been questioned by the country elite. "The rest of us wanted to be like him," says Christofferson. "He had integrity. He went his own way boldly. He was an outlaw, and that appealed to us. He went in his own direction, and nobody told him what to do." Later that year, Cash would record another Christofferson song, "To Beat the Devil," and he introduced Chris to the audience at the Newport Folk Festival. Christofferson had gone to the festival, as a fan, with Vince Matthews. When Cash heard that he was sleeping in an old church that offered space to hippies, he invited him to perform two songs during his show. Time was tight, and it was an extraordinarily prestigious spot to be given, especially to someone with no previous experience in performing for audiences. "I got to sing Sunday Morning Coming Down and Me and Bobby McGee," says Christofferson. "They went over so well that John told me on one of the last occasions that I spoke to him that the New York Times had said that I stole the show. I don't remember that. I do know that it went over well enough that they put me on at some of the afternoon workshops with people like Van Morrison, Joni Mitchell, and James Taylor, and that it started my performing career. It took me from being a guy who sat on a chair at John's house to getting an invitation to appear at the Berkeley Folk Festival. I never looked back." The third recording session that Cash permitted Elvstrom to film was one with Bob Dylan, who was in town to record Nashville Skyline with Bob Johnston. Since John Wesley Harding, also recorded by Johnston in Nashville, Dylan had turned away from the wild, drug-warped electric blues of his blonde-on-blonde period and toward the simple melodies and sentiments of country music. He had cut his instantly recognizable shock of unruly hair, had grown a beard, and now lived on a mountainside in upstate New York. Nashville Skyline, for which Cash wrote the liner notes in the form of a poem, captured Dylan's exploration of the country sound. The two men crossed paths at Columbia Studios on February 18th, and Bob Johnston thought he should take advantage of the situation. "There was no purpose to the session other than my selfishness," he says. "I've always tried to put people together, and I thought it would be wonderful if Dylan and Cash got together. They went out to eat, and while they were gone, I set up microphones, chairs, and stools, and put the lights on in a special way, so that when they got back and saw what I had done, they just chuckled, got their guitars, and began playing. I started requesting stuff, and 4 hours later, Dylan said, 'We finished.' Columbia never wanted it done." Gone was the nervousness that had been obvious 2 years before when they'd sung in a hotel room in front of Pennybaker's camera. They were more confident in each other's presence. Not much more than an improvised jam, the session included all the false starts, faltering vocals, and forgotten words expected from such a spontaneous get-together. Though most of the 18 tracks were too unpolished to ever be considered for release, one, "Girl from the North Country," became the opening track on Dylan's Nashville Skyline album. Elvstrom's film illustrated the variety of live shows Cash was performing. Dressed formally at the Ryman Auditorium, he accepted the CMA Album of the Year award for "Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison." With a voice filled with emotion, he accepted it on behalf of Luther Perkins, who had died 2 months previously of burns and smoke inhalation after falling asleep on a couch with a lighted cigarette. Cash played an unnamed county fair, a concert hall, Nashville's Tennessee State Prison, and the St. Francis Reservation in South Dakota. The day after the St. Francis concert, Elvstrom filmed Cash's visit to the site of the Battle of Wounded Knee, where, in December 1890, 146 members of the Minneconjou Lakota tribe were killed by the 7th United States Cavalry. This trip had been set up by John L. Smith, a fan who was not only an authority on Cash's recording career, and later his discographer, but was a student of Native American history. They first met after a concert in Des Moines in April 1967 and had since corresponded to exchange information about Native Americans.